Zainab Salbi is helping women around the world find the strength within themselves. Salbi's the founder of Women for Women International, a group that helps women rebuild their lives after the horrors of war. So far, they've given out about $9 million in aid and helped women in 10 countries, including Rwanda, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Iraq. Salbi says it's easy for her to understand the women she helps today.
I'm originally from Iraq, and I grew up with the Iran-Iraq war. So in many ways, I empathize, with the whole idea of surviving a war. Not to compare my experience with anybody's experience. It's just each have their own values and their own dynamics. But the whole idea of the vulnerability, of being dispossessed, of losing everything in your life, of losing loved ones in your life, is a very familiar idea for me. Not only that I go through some of it, but I lived with many people who've gone through all of these things. And so it came with my own background saying that we cannot just watch and say, oh, it's good that it's not happening to me. But we really do have responsibilities as human beings to do something as small as maybe stuffing an envelope or picking up a trash or whatever to make this world a better place. I do think that we each have an individual responsibility for that.
These days, you help women in over 20 countries, I understand. You must have met thousands of women by this time. I wonder, can you give us a sense of what these women have gone through?
Interesting, because you see similar patterns to the role of women in conflicts, from the negative pattern to the positive one as well. The challenges that women face historically and particularly in modern wars is that they are targeted as a weapon of war. In particular with rape. We started with women in Bosnia, where 20,000 women were raped in organized rape camps. Then the next war after that was Rwanda, where 450,000 women were raped over a 4 month period. And then it goes on and on and on. And the latest war is the Democratic Republic of Congo, in which the minimum that is estimated that about over 90,000 women who were raped in the last 5 years. And I recently came from there, and I think that this is the minimum estimate and not the maximum. There's a pattern of how women are viewed. Soldiers and people generally, you know, come, they kill, they pillage, and the rape of women goes with that. You know, it's almost consistent.
The horror of the size of what you're talking about is so large that the individual women almost disappear in that ugliness. But you have met the individual women, and I wonder, how do they deal with it? How does a woman whose name you know tell you her story?
Well, resilience. Over the time, I learned that we all have that resilience in us. It doesn't show itself until it is a crisis situation. So, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, recently I met a woman, her name is Nabito, and she sat with me for about an hour and a half talking about how 8 soldiers raped her in front of her children, how her boys were even actually forced to spread her legs and her hands as the soldiers were raping her, how her hands were broken 3 years ago and still is broken. She has not had the ability to fix it or to even go to the hospital. And this woman is sitting with me and talking to me about her dreams. And her dreams are so simple. She was saying that all what I want is to be able to feel like a human being again. To be able to feel like a woman again. And that entailed having her job. You know, she was a farmer, so she had some animals and some small land that she farmed. So being a human being again for her was to be able not to beg, to be able to earn a living. She wanted to be able to buy her own clothes and not have people just give her her clothes. She wanted to be able to have a decent slipper as opposed to the ones that she had made herself from trash, basically. But the resilience for her to stand up, to sit down, to talk about it, to keep on going. Another woman in Rwanda, Beatrice, 7 of her children died on top of her in one of the churches massacre. When I met her, she had adopted 5 children. She had built a small hut for them, and she's starting an income generating process. And she was looking at me with a smile, thanking me for listening to her and thanking the people who made it possible for me to even go to Rwanda to listen to her. So you hear these women's stories and the resilience that they are there, what they've been through, and that we're not giving up, that we're going to keep on going and we cannot afford to give up.
But it's not just listening to their stories that you do. Women for Women actually provide some help so that the woman in the Congo, for instance, can get a loan from you to help rebuild her farm, for instance?
Well, We have a three-pronged approach, actually. And the organization tried to help them move from a stage of victimhood to survivors to active citizens. And so with the humanitarian aid stage, we have a sponsorship program in which we connect women with women in the countries that we work with. Each sponsor sent the matched sister $25 a month, along with a letter to start communication link between the two women. Because a lot of times, the common thing also is the feeling of abandonment. So to get a letter from someone saying, I care, you exist, I'm going to be here for you, I'm not going to leave you, I'm going to help you, you know, stand on your feet. Immediately, as we sponsor them, we immediately start getting into tangible vocational skills training in which we can help them get employable skills. So it's a very intensive program that we meet with the women every single week for a whole year in which she's getting money, she's getting letters, she's getting two kinds of trainings, women's rights training as well as business skills trainings. And at the end of the year, she graduates with income generating opportunities. In our beliefs that the question to building peace in particularly countries in post-conflict actually has a lot to do with providing options and choices, tangible choices for women. We can't talk about democracy in a vacuum. We can't talk about wanting to help in a vacuum if we do not give them tangible opportunities to stand on their feet and to be financially as well as politically and socially independent.
These are success stories, and they're very nice to hear. Do they help you compensate for all of the horror stories that you have to listen to as well?
It makes it worth it, you know. It's a very hard thing to go and hear to these horror stories. But then, you know, you hear the success ones as well, and it just makes it worth it. My favorite is a woman named Zainaba in Bosnia. And she's a survivor of the Srebrenica massacre, one of the worst massacres in Bosnia. Her husband was in a prison camp for 2 years. By the time he was released, he was severely handicapped. When we first met her was back in 97. She had nothing whatsoever. I still have chills all over when I think about her. Nothing. She had cardboards where she slept with her children. Got into our program, got, you know, all the services that I just mentioned, got the loans, bought a cow. Long story short, I met her about 2 years ago, actually, and I still follow up her story. She had bought a house. She owns 7 cows, which is a big deal, actually. I don't know how many chicken, some sheep, all of these things. When I met with her, she was crying as well as smiling and just saying, everything is okay now. So you see that smiling, it's like, it's worth it. You know, you had to hear the horror, but it's worth it because to see that the resilience in human spirits, to see the courage they have, to say, I'm not giving up. I am going to continue going. And that's how I fight the enemy, by surviving, by keep on going, by building my country, by building my life.
Your home and where you started this project is Iraq, which has changed in the years since you first began Women for Women. What is life like for women in Iraq now?
Actually, Iraq is one of the last countries that we opened the office in because I couldn't start in Iraq. I started in Bosnia because Iraq was under Saddam Hussein's rule and no one could operate independently there. And I always felt it was unethical to promise people to deliver the services to the women if I cannot guarantee it. So we never did until after the war. And the first time I went to Iraq actually was 3 weeks after the war, about last May. Fascinating, actually, to be back home. Women have gone a lot through Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And a lot of times we don't have too much knowledge about it. We know about, Saddam did have a massive campaign to combat illiteracy, for example, and did have employment opportunities for women in both the formal as well as informal sector. There was about 30% representation of women in the Iraqi parliament. It was almost that, you know, the Ba'athist Party knew what was proper to say when it comes to women's issues. There was an Iraqi women union, all of these things. The cover, I always say, was good. Looked good. And that's what people still know about Iraqi women, and they don't know anything else. When I went back, there was institutionalized poverty, marginalized areas where women actually were majority of single heads of household. There was a lot of consequences on the political imprisonment and tortures of men, on the women, because they had to take care on. There was institutionalized violence, for example, carried on by the Ba'athist Party. Rape and sexual torture was often used as a way of political torture against the man or the woman herself. So, for example, to torture a man or a political opponent, often they raped his sister or his daughter or his mother and videotaped that, and they used that as part of his interrogation. women were actually sent back and forth. When there was a war with Iran, women took the leadership in terms of carrying on economic opportunities in Iraq. The minute the war was ended, women were sent back home. So there is mixed messaging constantly between what is the cover, the gift wrap, as I call it, and what was the content and the substance of it. And the substance was very much embedded in chauvinism and in misogyny. After the war, it wasn't necessarily that much easier. On the other hand, on the flip side, there's also a lot more opportunities for women. This is the time for Iraqi women to establish their new role in the new Iraq, to be part of the constitution, to be part of the new government, to have a voice in how they want to shape their role. And it's not imposed on them, but it's their own ownership. So there's the challenges that we really do need to acknowledge, and we need to acknowledge in a historical perspective what these women have been through. And there are lots of opportunities that are out there, and it's a matter of grabbing it, and it's a matter of providing it to as many women as possible.
Does it present particular problems for an organization like yours, Women for Women, to move into a country like Iraq where Islamic fundamentalism is beginning to take hold again? It's hard to understand, for instance, how women who have to cover themselves can at the same time begin to take power.
Not at all. You know what? I call it as our political burqa in here. You know, the burqa, you know, when I go to Afghanistan, I try it on just to see out of curiosity. And it's a horse blinder. You know, you only see what's straight in front of you. What we really need to do is lift it, us in the West, in here, lift it and see the complexity, as I said, of women's lives. As I was growing up, for example, my high school friend had to fight for months with her family to allow her to cover her hair. It's her family who were against it, and she was crying and begging and all of these things until, you know, they gave up and allowed her to cover her hair. A lot of times the covering of the actual hair, that whether it's the chador or whether it's the burqa or whether it's just a simple headscarf, is actually irrelevant a lot of times. What's relevant is the choices. Are the women making the choices to cover or uncover? Every time I go to Afghanistan or even to Iraq, and it's like, well, how about you're still wearing the burqa? And it's like, who cares? We want jobs. We want real choices. Who cares about what we're wearing?
Zainab Salbi is the founder and president of Women for Women International.